So first of all, I should say thank you to the organisers for arranging such an interesting meeting with quite diverse interests represented. So I was going to say it's the first time I've ever been to a meeting where I didn't know a single person that was there. But Dorothy's turned up and spoiled it, so I can't say that anymore. So the subject is one of classical nonlinear field theory. So that's the kind of thing I do to make a living. I work on things that generally usually apply to particle physics. So things like skirmions, non-abelian magnetic monopoles, Yandell's instantons, those kind of things. And the topic I'm going to tell you about sort of fits into that pattern. The original application was to describe some exotic states in high energy physics called glue balls. I'm not going to tell you anything in the main bit of the talk about the applications, but I'll mention some things at the end. So in that sense, it's not going to be so much a talk on mathematical physics, but more physical mathematics. So I'll try to persuade you why it might be interesting to look at this model regardless of applications. One of the reasons is that it's a very simple field theory, but the solutions are very interesting, have some novel properties. So in particular, these minimal energy soliton solutions are string-like, and they like to tie themselves into knots and links. So in terms of the terminology that we had in earlier talks, these are spontaneous rather than engineered, and that's much harder to come by. So I guess an analogy is that it's maybe not so surprising that you can tie your shoelace into a knot, but it's a bit more surprising if you untie them and when you take your hands away, they tie themselves back into a knot. And that's the kind of thing that happens here. So I started this work a long time ago, in the last millennium, in collaboration with Richard Batty, who's in Manchester. And more recent work has been with Martin Speight, who's in Leeds, and Derek Harland, who was my postdoc in Durham at the time, but now is a lecturer in Loughborough. But almost everything I'll tell you about today you can find in this middle paper here if you want to look up some more references. So here's the outline. So Act 1 will be telling you about the topology of hot solitons. So I wasn't quite sure about the background of people here or what you would know, but it seems that everybody knows about the topology of hot solitons or something similar, anyway, from the talks that we've seen so far. So I'll be fairly brief in going through that. Then I'll introduce this model to you called the Skirnpadeyev model and tell you something about its soliton solutions and relation to knots. And then in the conclusion, I'll mention some things about applications. Right, so here's 101 on topology of maps, simplest kind of thing you could write down. Suppose we just have a map from the plane to a two-sphere. So a three-component unit vector defined everywhere in the plane. So if you want to think about, have a physical model in your head, think about n as being a unit vector giving you the local orientation of a magnetization in some magnet. So a ferromagnetic material, everywhere there's a direction for the magnetization. That's what this unit vector is. And if you've got a very thin sample, it's essentially two-dimensional. So you could have that picture in your mind if you want. So you then impose some boundary condition that's going to come from finite energy, that if you go far enough away in your sample, then the boundary condition is that the unit vector goes in some fixed direction, which I'll take to be the k direction. So it'll go to 0, 0, 1 as you go far away. So that makes a topological compactification. The plane is now topologically a sphere. Just think of stereographic projection where the North Pole goes to infinity and that's all identified. So such maps are classified by an integer. This, the maps between two spheres are classified by the second Tomography group of the two sphere, and that's the integers. And I think we've seen this before in a few other talks. It depends how you want to think about this integer, depending on what kind of person you are. So if you're a geometer, you probably say, well, I'll get that integer by integrating the pullback of the area to form on the two sphere. So that's this expression here. So give me any field n, function of x and y, satisfies this boundary condition, do this integral, and you get an integer. That's the kind of thing that in my field we call a topological charge. So I'm going to be interested in things where I want to, say, have some energy function and minimize the energy with a fixed topological charge. That's the kind of game I like to play. So if you're not a geometer or you like things pictorially, here's a picture of what the winding number is. Everywhere in space we've got this vector, unit vector. It's going to point up if you go far enough away, so they're the blue arrows. So this integer tells you how many times every other direction appears in space. So here's an example where the topological charge is 1, so every direction is taken exactly once. So if you like, this integer is a winding number. It tells you as you scan through your sample, how many times do I cover this 2-sphere. Okay. So in particular, since far away the spin points up, an obvious definition of where this object is located is where the spin point down, because that's as far away as possible that you can get from the vacuum. So if I had some configuration that looks like this, any reasonable person, and we've already had that definition at some point, would say that the soliton is located here, where the spin point's down. So that's my definition of where a soliton will be. So I haven't told you anything about energy functions or anything like that. I've just told you about topology. So the kind of thing that we do is say, now give me an energy function for this field. So write down some energy function. So it might be, for example, I could take the gradient of n squared. If you were thinking of this as being the direction for some magnetization, that would be the exchange interaction energy for a magnet. I guess the same thing also occurs if you think about this as being some pneumatic, you'd have a gradient of n squared term in your elastic energy. So write down some energy and then try to minimize this thing. So if you go to ferromagnets, particularly if you go to chiral ferromagnets, the energy looks, the first term looks something like gradient of n squared. And very recently, in the last couple of years, people have been able to image topological solitons. So things with the structure I've just pointed out to you. These are sort of, this is about 100 nanometers across. So this is some chiral magnet. And what you can see is they're able to image the in-plane direction for the magnetization. So my thing was that if you go so far away out here, it's going to point, spin's going to point up. If you're right in the center here, the spin points down. In both cases, there's no in-plane component, so they both look black. And then you take every other possible spin, so you see that the spins wind around here. So this is what we call a baby skirmion. If you're a condensed matter person, you're not a very good parent, you neglect the baby, and you just call them skirmions. But skirmions appear in particle physics. So we call these baby skirmions to distinguish that. And I'll try and use that name.
Is that because they're really just two-dimensional?
That's the main distinction. These things are two-dimensional and skirmions are three-dimensional. So in fact, there was a... Maybe I should tell this in case the person who wrote it is in the room. No, go on, I'll say it. We're on the record, aren't we? So just before this paper appeared, I got an email from one of the journalists at Nature saying, we're going to be publishing a paper on skirmions, and we want to write some commentary about this paper. Can we phone you, and you can tell us what a skirmion is? So I was at some conference in Greece, in fact on a beach, because they're very relaxed at conferences in Greece, when this email came through. So I didn't read it until later on in the day, and that's a day is far too long for a journalist. All right, so by the time that I'd read this email, she'd already sent another one saying, I couldn't get in contact with you, I've got somebody else. So I was quite interested to see what this somebody else wrote about skirmions when this paper came out, bearing in mind that most of my life I've spent working on skirmions in particle physics. So I read this thing, the first line of it, I'm paraphrasing, but pretty much said, skirmions were first invented in particle physics, but they're no use for that. But now they're useful in magnets, or something like this. So I guess the moral is that you snooze, you lose. But I would have written something a bit more complimentary about the stuff I work on if it was if I'd have been there. Never mind. Anyway, that was.
There's a journalist who sent the lunchtime thing. I think she'd take it up with her.
Well, I don't think she's the journalist that wrote it, but I think she didn't quote her sources, because that's the person I need to have a quiet word with. Right, so this is all 2D stuff. I'm really going to be interested in 3D stuff, so let's do everything I've just told you about. Let's increase the space dimension by 1. So think about topology of maps from three space dimensions to the sphere. So everything looks almost the same. We've got a three-component unit vector now defined in three-dimensional space. Think of it as being a magnet again. Now it's a three-dimensional magnet, so a full sample. Same boundary condition, it's going to point up if you go far enough away. So space is compactified from R3 to S3. And just as before, they're classified by maps, but this time Pi3, the third homotopy group of the two-sphere. That's also the integers. So there's again an integer, but this time it's not a simple winding number, it's not a degree anymore. Again, if you're a geometer, you probably want to think about it this way. You'd say, well, this, if I pull back the area 2 form on the 2 sphere this time, I get some closed 2 form, F. But the cohomology is trivial, so that must also be exact. So I can write F as dA. And then if I integrate this Chern-Simons form, that's my integer. So if you're a geometer, that's probably how you think of it. If you like pictures, this is how you think of it. So take any point on the target 2 sphere, so this red point, for example. Think about all the points that map to that point. So all the points in space, so the pre-image of that. All the points in space where the fields point in this direction. That generically will be some closed loop. Take any other point on the 2 sphere. That will also be some closed loop. And count how many times those are linked. That's the same integer. So this hop invariant is a linking number. So the things I'm going to write down, the energies, the energy expression in terms of n, will be invariant under rotations of that target 2 sphere. But we've already chosen a point. We've said that at infinity, the spin points up. So we've chosen a point which is going to be the North Pole. So that breaks the whole symmetry of the problem. There's still a rotational symmetry around the axis that goes through the North Pole and the South Pole. And in particular, what that means is that we'll have distinguished another point, as well as the North Pole, we'll distinguish the South Pole, because that's the other point on this axis. So although you can draw this pre-image for any curve, the natural one to draw is the pre-image of the South Pole, because that's the one that's invariant under this rotation symmetry. And if you remember, that South Pole, that's pointing down, that's where we said a soliton position is. So if you draw the pre-image of the South Pole, that will give you a curve. And that's the curve of this position of the soliton. So that's why these are a bit novel, because in most of the kind of things we do, the position of a soliton is a point, like in the two-dimensional example. It will be sort of kind of some lump of energy, and it will be the center of that lump. Here, the solitons are kind of string-like rather than point-like, and that's quite unusual.
And you pick that one out because of energetic reasons.
The South Pole. No, it's symmetry reasons, because the whole thing will be invariant under rotations. So the North Pole breaks that symmetry down to a circle. So I can, the circle symmetry is rotating the sphere around the equator.
But you could pick any axis, could you not?
Oh yeah, so what, I just picked some random direction, which I've chosen to be 0, 0, 1.
Just a convention to pick.
Yeah, so I could choose any. But once I've chosen that, then there's a rotation left. And the point antipodal to that is the only other one fixed by that rotation. So in other words, if I draw the pre-image of something like this, the reason not to choose that is that there's a symmetry that rotates this around, and then this curve would move. If I draw the South Pole, there is no symmetry that rotates it around, so this curve is fixed. So it's a more invariant object to draw.
Physically, there might be good reasons, but topologically, you get a point in that from S3 to the 2 sphere.
Because that would have infinite energy.
If
you had something like the gradient of the field squared, it has to go to a constant. Okay. So, any questions?
Just so you're,
since I move on,
a historical point is this was first observed in liquid crystals, right? By Boulogne.
Real samples, yes. So, yeah. So one of the things is that observing this in ferromagnets has not been done. So the two-dimensional plots that I showed you of observing the planar baby skirmions, they're only 2 years ago. Right. People haven't seen these, but I think they exist.
And liquid crystals, you see them.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the ferromagnet one. So I agree that liquid crystals are ahead of the game in terms of experimental stuff. In ferromagnets, I believe they exist, but no one's been able to see them. One of the difficulties is knowing how to image inside for a magnet. They can image on the surface, but they don't know how to look inside. You need some kind of magnetic resonance, but at a much smaller scale.
I don't understand. For liquid crystal, it's a hemisphere. North pole and south pole are the same.
Yeah, but you can orient, as long as there are no disclination loops, you can orient them globally.
You can pick an orientation.
And then the pre-image of one of the cross polarizers get north and south. So you don't even have to be clever, right? You get the north and the south pre-image.
Okay.
And you get the linked loops. Isn't that paper posted? Fools so did that.
Yeah, that's one of the heroes of knotted fields.
Unfortunately, he did it in French.
C'est la vie. Okay, so let me give you an energy function, because I haven't told you anything about energy functions. So this is a Skjerm-Fadejev model. So this was first introduced by Fadejev in some preprint, Princeton preprint that never got published in 75. And nobody did anything with it because it was too hard to do anything with it back in 75. But it became popularized in a paper by Fadejev and Niemi in Nature in 97. So here's what the energy function is. So some convenient normalization. This is the term that I said you would have if you had a ferromagnet, or I guess elastic energy, some pneumatic, so gradient of n squared. So what's novel about this is that as well as this term that's quadratic in derivatives, you have a term that's quartic in derivatives. So it looks like you take a cross product between the x and y derivative, you take the norm of that squared, plus cyclicking x, y, z. So same term with x, z, and y, z. Q
was,
this thing.
That's
so Q is the hot topological charge. So that's the model. So what their Nature article does is say, here's a model. We expect just from the topology arguments I've just given you that there will be the solitons, minimal energy solutions in a given charge sector will be string-like. Strings can form knots. Perhaps this has solitons that are knotted. That's kind of their paper. So what can you prove about this? So you can prove it as an energy bound. So in each topological charge sector, which you have to stay in if you're thinking about infinite systems with finite energy, you can't jump from one charge sector to the next because that requires infinite energy. So there's an energy lower bound that says that the energy is greater than the topological charge to the 3/4 times some constant. So this is quite unusual. For the kind of systems that we're interested in. Quite often you have a topological bound, but it says that the energy is greater than or equal to some constant times the number of times the topological charge, not this funny fractional power.
I mean, your comment that you can't jump from one charge to another must depend on that fourth grad n squared.
No, because you have to change the boundary conditions.
Right? Yeah, you can shrink the.
So you could worry about scaling and shrink it down to zero scale. So Derek's theorem is what provides a finite scale for this. Topologically, you would say you could go to zero scale, and then it's a question whether you'd count that as an unwinding or not. So this has been proved with a value of C that's about a half, but the conjecture that hasn't been proved is that this is true with C being 1. Well, 1 because I've chosen my normalization to make that constant 1. And it's known that this 3/4 power is strict, so you can't do any better. And we'll see in sort of numerical results that they are consistent with this C being 1.
So that's either, I know for analogous problems, having where Q is replaced with sort of not invariants, you get similar things to that 3/4 profit, but that's something like crossing number at asymptotic crossing number. So,
yeah. So this comes in quite hard analysis. So you have to look at Sobel F inequalities and all those kind of things.
So just besides Q, besides this pi 3, mm-hmm. Are there other conjectures for depending on the complexity of the
Q? So that's what I'm going to tell you about what the energy is if you make the things more complex. Right. So this is the game is run through possible values of Q, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Find the field configuration with a given boundary condition that it goes to this constant far away, find the minimal energy field configuration with that value of Q. So minimize this energy. So if you like, you could write it as solving some PDE. You could do the variation of this and write down the PDE. And that's what it looks like. So how might we think about writing down some field configuration to at least start with that had a hot charge, anything we wanted, so we could then minimize it? So one way is to start with these two-dimensional solids that I told you about at the beginning that had this integer little q. These are these things that take all possible values. So a two-dimensional thing here, which is points in the down direction at the center. So start with that. That was two-dimensional, so I can embed it in three-dimensional space by just dragging it around a closed loop. So if you like, I could make a string of these things by just saying everything was invariant in the third direction. That will give me an infinite string. I'll take a chunk of that and join the ends up. So if I take one of those, and this had charge Q, and I make it into a loop, and I make this has as I said, there's a circle symmetry. You can rotate this two-dimensional thing. So as you drag it around this loop, rotate it n times. So if you do that, it's easy to show that this is a field, satisfies all the right boundary conditions, is smooth, and its Hopf invariant is the product of the two-dimensional charge you put in and the number of times you twist. So I'll call this, my notation is this is AMQ, so A for axial, this is an axially symmetric configuration. So M is the number of times you twisted and Q was the charge of the two-dimensional solid on that you started with.
I'm sorry, the vector field pointing out. So on the torus.
Yes. So if you plotted all the points where the field was pointing down, that would be a loop, a circle, yeah?
I see.
Then as you move away from that circle, the field starts to point more up, and as you go around the circle, it rotates. So it covers. So any pre-image, any direction you take, pre-image will be a closed loop. I'll show you a picture in a second, if you like.
But this has no hedgehog charge. If you measure the pi 2 of this, you get 0.
Correct, because the pi 2 of that bit, if you just isolated a cross-section here, the pi 2 of that would be this integer q. But the way to think about it, if you do a cross-section, there'll be the same one here, but it will have minus q. Yeah, agreed. So it's just classified by q. But it gives you a way of writing down some initial conditions that have any Hopf invariant you like. And you could ask what happens to them. In particular, you could ask, is the minimal energy charge one solution? Does it look like this? And the answer is yes. So start with the configuration that looks like that and do some energy minimization. So here's the result of energy minimization. So what I'm plotting here is the position of the soliton. So I want to plot the pre-image of 0, 0, minus 1, pre-image of pointing down. So that would be a curve, but it's very hard to see a curve, so I've thickened it out so you can see it, by plotting an isosurface where the third component is something like minus 0.9, or something close to minus 1. So most of all the solutions I'll show you by plotting a pre-image of the position, so pre-image of down. And that's a circle. To see that it's linked, plot the pre-image of any other point. So that's what this green curve is. It's pre-image at some point close to the South Pole. And you see it links exactly once. So that shows that the linking number is 1, Q is 1. And when you minimize, you get an energy for this thing that's about 20% above this conjecture band. So all nice and easy. We have the first thing that was conjectured in the paper, in the Nature paper. Here's a string-like soliton, and it's stable.
And is this and the ring is the only sort of locus where it's pointing down everywhere?
Yes. Yeah. Right. So there, all the points are pointing down.
So is this the minimum energy configuration, or is there something with lower energy?
So with Hopf charge 1, this is the minimal energy. You can't do better.
Okay. So then the conjecture with C equals 1 isn't realized with Hopf charge 1.
Yes.
It's 20% higher.
Well, it's a bound, so it's realized.
So there's no solution in such a bound?
No, you can prove that there's no solution that attains that bound.
But
does that mean that there's a better estimate, or potentially one could come up with a better estimate for the coefficient C than C equals 1?
That's unlikely. I'll tell you why it's unlikely, is because you can achieve that if you start not on R3, but on a 3-sphere of a fixed radius, with a critical radius. Then you can achieve that bound. And so what this constant to tell you is something about the difference between the 3-sphere and R3. You're asking, what do I mean by stable? I mean, any perturbation you like, this has no negative eigenvalues in the perturbation. It's a global minimum of the energy in the charge one sector. Okay. You can't do any better than that.
So I'm still, I just want to get back to what you're saying. The second variation you can see is strictly positive.
Yes.
But that's a different.
It's true, that doesn't prove it's a global minimum. So what you can do is do lots of perturbations. Of course, it's all numerical. So do lots of perturbations, start with lots of kind of things, and find out you can't do any better. And you don't expect to be able to do much better because it's only 20% above this bound, so there's not a lot of room for maneuver anyway. So what about moving on to charge 2? So it turns out that the Hof number 2 solution also looks like this axial thing that I wrote down. So this time you would have a choice. So the one that looks, the one that has, that is the global minimum is A21. So this means take the charge one planar thing, drag it around a loop, but twist it twice. So here's the position, here's the pre-image of the position and another curve, and you see they're linked twice. And that one does a little bit better in terms of this bound. It's about 17% above the bound. So there would be an alternative, which would be A12. You could take the charge two planar one and just twist it once. There is a critical point that looks like that, but it's unstable. It's a saddle point to the energy. Perturb it and it goes to this.
And S3 would be the same R3.
Yes. So you might spot a pattern here and think it's going to be a bit boring because the answer is going to be AQ1. And then it would be a bit boring, but already 3 tells you that's not right. So here's the minimal energy for 3. So it's almost A31, but it's not actually symmetric anymore. There's been you've twisted it 3 times now, and you can see here. But 3 times is too much of a twist, and it buckles. So this is a famous buckling instability that you'd see, for example, in elastic rods.
Proved by the critical threshold.
Yep. So between 2 and 3 is the critical threshold. Because 2, when you twist, it doesn't buckle, and 3, when you twist. So for a smooth field configuration, you have to twist an integer number of times.
And how do you determine that value? Do you determine that value in this context or by analogy?
So I'll show you something later which will try and determine that, but here it's just experimental. All right, you've twisted it twice, it didn't buckle, you twist it 3 times and it does. All right, so it's the same thing that you would be doing with an elastic rod. You took an elastic rod and twisted it before you joined the ends. With an elastic rod, you can twist any revolution you like. Here, to make the fields join, it has to be an integer, 2π integer twist. It's essentially that Mitchell's instability proved in 1889. These things buckle if you twist them enough. So what you might expect now, if you've seen this, is you think, well, the minimal energy at charge 4 will probably be something like this that's buckled a bit more. There is a solution like that, and this time that one is stable, but it's only a local energy minimum. You can do better, and you can do better by doing 822. So you take the planar soliton that had charge 2 and twist it twice. And that's what this configuration looks like here. And again, you'll notice things are settling down now at about 20% above this bound. So I've given you 4 things, and they've sort of done 3 different things. So what's the guess for charge 5? So what do you think 5 looks like? There's not so much choice because 5 is prime.
Right.
All right. So this is very interesting research because it's like Elves and the Shoemaker. You set your program running. You go home, you have a good night's sleep, and then you see what it is in the morning, and it's sometimes a surprise. Yeah, you think it might buckle a lot. Well, here's the answer. Give that man a prize. So this time I said that you take the pre-image of any point and it will be generically a closed curve. Well, generically it will be a collection of closed curves. So this is just, again, the pre-image of all the points that point down. But this time it has 2 components it decides to make. So this component, if I just had this component on its own, here you can see the winding, this would be charge 1. And if I had just this component on its own, you can see the winding, this would be charge 2. So it's a link from a charge 1 and a charge 2. Now, I was never very good at arithmetic, but last time I looked, 1 plus 2 wasn't 5. But here, because you link, you have to count the pre-image of the linking with all component curves. So you get a charge 1 from this, a charge 2 from this, but then if you look at the red curve and the green one of the other component, they link once, and vice versa. So this is hot charge 5 because you get a 1 plus a 2 plus 2 bonus linkings from the linking of each of itself. And this is the origin of why you get this growth that's sublinear in Q. It's because to make charge 5, you only have to add 1 and 2. You don't have to add things to the earth to make it 2. Right, good. So now you guess what happens for charge 6. It's not very much different to charge 5. All you do is you change the charge of one of the linked components. You take 2 charge 2s and link them once. And that gives you 6. So 2 plus 2 plus bonus 1 from each of them. So same question. What do you think 7 looks like? I have one vote for trefoil. So you should have got it because I already showed you it. So if you looked at the picture carefully, you would have seen how many times it twists.
Could you give me chiral bias, Paul?
Yes, you can get chiral, but they if you change the chirality, you would change Q to minus Q. Mm. So here, this is the first time a knot appears, so this is verifying the other conjecture, Fadeh and Yomi's conjecture in their Nature paper. Maybe these things might like to form knots. Well, the answer is yes, they do. And you have to go to charge 7. So you see, we've got a trefoil knot, simply knot, that has a self-linking crossing number of 3. So this is charge 7, so we can see is that the rest of the charge has to be made up by 4 twists as you go around. So if you count the green curve going out of the red one, it twists 4 times, and then plus the crossing number gives you something charge 7. So that's the minimal energy configuration of hot charge 7. So if you want to see how to get these things, so what's the kind of thing that you come in to see in the morning when you've had a good night's sleep and the computer's worked hard for you? So here's how a typical energy minimization run would go. You have to start with something that has charge 7. Really the only thing I know how to start with at this point is I take this axisymmetric thing where it's charge 1 in the cross section, twist it 7 times. So that's the axial A71. Start with that, that's unstable, and then you're minimizing the energy. And then it's this. So you see it buckling because it's twisted too much. Then there's a reconnection, and you think it's finished and made some link, but it's not quite done. It does another one. And now it's settling down to its minimal energy state. So it's got the right topology. Now it has to get the right conformation. And there you go, it stops.
All right. And if you do this in S3, you get...
Nobody's done it in S3. It would be interesting to do it.
S3, all the torus knots obviously have nice orbital configurations.
Yeah, so probably a simpler problem from the point of view of the structure of the solutions, maybe a slightly more difficult one from numerical minimization.
Am I to believe that that is the dynamics, or that's just numerical minimization?
So there's two things you could do. So this could be one of two things, and it's neither. But I'll tell you the two things it could be, and either of those are a good thing to think about. They give you the right kind of picture. It could be gradient flow. So I could just do energy minimization flowing the gradient. There is a natural dynamics associated with this. I've only talked about energies, but in fact it comes from a relativistic Lagrangian field theory. So there's an automatic second-order dynamics. You could do second-order dynamics plus add some small dissipation. That's not quite it, but that's close to it. So what, in fact, we do is we do something that's between the two that is much more efficient in terms of going to the solution, which is you run full second-order dynamics, but periodically remove all kinetic energy. Remove all kinetic energy.
Oh,
so set all time
derivatives.
Like
dissipation.
Yeah. So that's what that really was. OK.
Well, if it were driven by some dynamical features, would you be able to say a flow driven by curvature, torsion, or combination, or?
Well, that's kind of moving away from the conference, right? You would want to think of this as just being a curve instead of being a field. And I'll tell you at the end, that's the more recent work, how good an approximation is that, how far you can get with that kind of thing.
I have another question here.
Yes.
Jeff Wall is chiral map. So, how does the symmetry breaking occur here?
So I think that's what Dorothy asked. There's a choice in the orientation that you twist when you start. So the initial condition. Yeah. So you could twist it the other way and do a minus 7. But the energy is symmetric. So
higher Q,
so you want to know what happens for higher Q? Good, because that's what I'm going to tell you about.
Paul, before you do that, can I just ask, when you see the reconnections, is there any sort of thing that you can see in the energy as you're minimizing the energy? Does it change more slowly, more rapidly, actually, during the reconnections?
Yeah, so you can see a burst of radiation, but it's very small.
I guess that's the sort of thing that would be more sensitive if you were making this more dynamical.
Well, no, it is dynamical. It's fine. You can do the full dynamics on this. All that happens is it passes through, it does some more reconnections, then it comes back. It does the same thing, but it does a few more reconnections. Vibrating around till it eventually slows down. That's why it's better to do this, because you don't have to wait so long in your minimization.
I want to make a comment about the links on the back on the previous slide. So it's neat, right? It's neat. It's a mystery in the liquid crystals that Dasha spoke about. If you just try to characterize the winding or the cue by looking at one of the loops, you miss it. There's an ambiguity. You can't. If you just try to classify what you have by looking at the surface of one torus,
right?
You miss it because you don't know what it's linked by.
Right.
And that's the whole field. That's the rest of the field acting.
Yeah.
So what's surprising is that you guys can treat the things as if you don't worry about the other things. So that must be some energetic. There's some energetic choice.
Yes, but in the integrated charge conservation, exactly the same thing appears because you have a sum of all the elements of a linking matrix,
which
includes the linking numbers, so it's exactly the same scale.
Right, but when you just talk about this, a single loop, the twist still seems to be a good topological number.
Yeah. Right, so your question was, how do you fill in the rest of this diagram? So I've shown you charges 1 to 6. Yeah, the energy sort of settled down about 20%. 2 is anomalously low. It's only down here. But after that, it's about 20%. And all these things so far were unknots or links. And then at 7, you got this trefoil. So the question is, what happens here? And it's not so easy. So I was stuck for quite a while to figure out what happens here. And the reason is that there's lots, I've already mentioned some local minima. There are lots and lots of local minima in this problem, and it's very easy to get stuck in them. So here's a typical sort of sketch of what field configurations versus energy looks like. There's lots of local minima, like this yellow point here. You're trying to get the global minimum down here. So what you typically do in some energy minimization problem like this, with lots of local minima, is a multi-start algorithm. So you start at lots and lots of different points in field configuration space, flow them all, and hopefully get to the one you want. What's tricky here is that, from what I've shown you so far, I only know how to start with one thing. The only thing I can write down is this axis symmetric thing. So I can only start, say, here. And so I'm always going to end up here. So I need some better way of starting. What I'd like to do would be able to start with lots of different field configurations. So start with, give me any Hopf charge, I want to be able to start with all possible links and knots that have that Hopf charge, and then relax them all and see which is stable and which gives the lowest energy. So the breakthrough is to be able to, I want to be able to do things like this, for example, to answer your question. Are there other knots? So simplest thing to think about, torus knots. So we've seen we've got the trefoil, but what about taking something in with higher crossing numbers? So you might expect that higher crossing number, that gives a extra contribution to the Hopf invariant. You might expect these might appear at larger Hopf invariant. So I want to be able to start with things that look like this. So here's how to do it. So you use a classic description of a knot by taking a knot as an intersection of a three-sphere with some complex curve. So this is standard description of the knot. I can take my three-sphere just to be a pair of complex numbers so that their modulus squared and added is 1. That makes my three-sphere intersection. The question is how to turn that description into a field configuration N. So the answer is to use two stereographic projections. So my N vector lies on a two-sphere, so I'm going to use a Riemann sphere coordinate. I'm going to do a stereographic projection and exchange my vector N. So I'm trying to get a map from R3 to S2. I'm going to exchange a vector N for a complex coordinate that can take infinity, so CP1 variable, stereographic projection. And I'm also going to exchange my coordinates in R3 for these coordinates, Z that lie in S3. Again, just stereographic projection is the relation between them.
So what is alpha and beta on your slide?
Well, I haven't got there yet. I'll tell you when I get there.
Okay.
All right. So you can see what I'm doing is exchanging, instead of having a map that I want from R3 to S2, I can think of some map that takes these coordinates, Z0, Z1, and gives me a Riemann sphere coordinate out of them. So if you remember, so if you do stereographic projection here, projecting from, say, the South Pole, where W is infinite, that's where the field takes the South Pole, so that's where the knot, that's where the position of the string will be. That's where the unit vector points down. So if I put this complex curve as the denominator in my Riemann sphere coordinate, that ensures that the location of the string will be exactly on this torus knot, because that's where the denominator vanishes. The numerator now, what conditions will that have to satisfy? Well, if I go far off in space, I need that the spin goes to pointing up. So in this Riemann sphere coordinate, that means W has to go to zero. So if you track through this stereographic projection, what you find is the required condition is that the Z1 goes to zero, so I need to have at least one factor of Z1 on the numerator. That will give me the right boundary conditions as I go off to infinity. So I'm going to, so this is a choice. Remember, I'm only trying to get initial conditions. I don't have to need to be solving anything. So I'm going to take just this rational map form, where I take the simplest thing on the top, which is Z1 to any power, which will have to be positive, so alpha 1 or more, the integer power, and Z0 to any other integer power. So the reason for taking this simple thing is what I want to know is what's the Hopf invariant of this field. And by taking this to be very simple in the numerator here, I can calculate the Hopf invariant. So if you take this simple form, it's easy to see that the Hopf invariant is this cross ratio. It's alpha B plus beta A. That's not too hard to see. You just have to extend the map. It's a map from S3 into CP1. You extend it by looking at the map, filling in the interior ball. Then it's a map to something four-dimensional. You write homogeneous coordinates on your Riemann sphere. So that gives you two complex coordinates. Then this is a map between two four-dimensional spaces. You can calculate the degree and its intensity.
So you call it probability. So if A and B are relatively prime, then you find integers, but not necessarily positive ones.
So you can't
satisfy that one.
No, Q is going to be
exactly. I'm just trying to think.
Right. So it's not guaranteed that every value of Q, given a curve here, so given the knot type, that every value of Q will appear. That's true.
But you want alpha beta to be positive integers.
Beta doesn't have to be alpha does. So beta can be zero. They're both non-negative, but beta could be.
Yes,
the beta could.
Yeah.
So they can't be negative. So here's an example. So if I want the trefoil knot, I know what polynomial. This is a complex curve for the trefoil knot. So I just have to think of put numbers here, and I want it to be charged 7 because that's what my numerics told me. So I want to put numbers here so that something times 2 plus something times 3 is 7, and so the somethings have to be 2 and 1, right? 2 times 2 plus 3 times 1. So that's a field with Hopf charge 7. So you can ask, what does that look like? So that's just the initial condition. It looks like this. So here's my trefoil knot, and it twists 4 times and gives me Hopf charge 7. So that's an initial condition, which you can see doesn't look too far away from the thing that I showed you as the energy minimizer. So as you can imagine, you take this and minimize the energy, it goes to the correct solution I found before. a lot quicker than starting with this axial thing, twisting, reconnecting. All right, so this is a vast improvement. You can start with lots of things, very quickly get to Cfres local energy minima. So in particular,
sorry, can I just add, if you were to do that with a lower hop charge, then you watch it on knot and it would become the link or whatever.
20 seconds, and I'll show you that. So, just to spend 20 seconds on just saying you can obviously do links, the same thing, you just have to have these that are a factor. So you're on the bottom. So here, for example, charge 6, put this factor on the bottom, you have to find that numbers are 2 and 1, and that looks very similar to the charge 6 that I showed you. Relax that down, you get the charge 6. And if you want to be very boring, you can do these axial ones in this formulation. It just takes you just take the monic with M and Q as the powers. So to answer your question, here's if you start with something with lower charge. So in fact, I'm still on the record, aren't I? I should say quietly. In fact, in the Fadeev and Niemi Nature paper, they say that trefoil should appear at charge 3, of charge 3, and they provide some numerical evidence for it. The numerical evidence is not very good because the statement is false. So you can check it. Here's an example that. So what we've seen is that you need to get to charge 7 before you get trefoil. So suppose you tried, like you say, try charge 5. Start with something. So I just use one of those polynomials I just said. I haven't drawn the linking, but you can count them at length. This is twisted twice, and see what happens if you start with this and minimize. That's the initial condition. You want it to be a knot, but it doesn't want to be a knot. Right, so it reconnects, and there's the charge 5 minimal energy solution that we saw as the link. Right. So that's why you can easily check there's no trefoil knots with lower charge than 7. It's just energetically unstable.
So their claim is the preimage of a particular direction?
The same preimage I'm showing you. Okay. They claim that this curve, that the preimage of down would be a trefoil knot. So I can see why they think it. Right? If you had no twist, the charge would be 3.
Right.
It's just it's unfavorable to have no twist.
I see. And down is where you would say your soliton is concentrated. So they weren't claiming that there's some other...
No. They're claiming exactly this, that this thing I showed you, if you had no twist, would be a trefoil knot.
So this is what you're saying, spontaneous versus engineered, because you can engineer anything you like, but it just doesn't...
Right, so you can engineer something to start with, initial conditions, with charge 3 that are a trefoil knot, like you can charge 5, but you minimize the energy, it's not as there's no solution that corresponds to that, not even a local minimum. Whereas there is if you get to charge 7. So you can, if you don't have anything else to do, if England have been knocked out of the football and you've bored, something like that. So I probably did this just after we lost the last tournament. You can set up lots and lots of initial conditions with various, so pick a hop charge, set up knots, links, axial things, see what happens to them all. Work out what kind of critical points you get, local energy minimum, global ones, work out all their energies. So memorize that table, because I'll ask you questions on it later. No. Yes, good. Well, let me go through the table first, and I'll get down there, because that's a question I wanted to ask you. So let's pick a number like charge 8, right? So what do the results tell you for charge 8? So lots of things, what can you think of for charge 8? You could start with 2 charge 3s linked once, that's this notation here. 2 charge 2s linked twice, a 4 and a 2 linked once each, a trefoil knot, some other higher torus knot, something that's 8, axial twisted 8 times. Do all that and you get one of two configurations as local energy minima. You either get this one, so 2 charge 3s linked once, or you get a charge 8 trefoil. So this is just like the charge 7, except this time it's twisted 5 times as you go around. And these are very close in energy, but this one's slightly lower. So this is the global minimum and this is a local minimum. And in this case, you get the global minimum more often if you... Well, the statistics are not very large because I'm only starting with a few, but you get this more often than you get this one. Right. So that's 8. If you look down at 9, so let's look at the column 9, you start with lots of things, various links. What you find is that most of the time, you get a trefoil knot. lots of things go to K3 too, but just occasionally you get something else, and the something else you get is this. So this is the first time that three components appear. So each of these links is these rings is charged one. So that gives you three, but each one is linked to both other ones. So they each get a bonus linking of two, and so that sums to nine.
So is that a 3-3 point? I mean, the pre-image of 3 points on?
No, so this is just a pre-image of 1 point.
No, it's a link. It's a link.
Right, so as a... So if you took the pre-image... So if you took the pre-image of one more point, it would just be circling around these curves.
Which
yeah, so that's my question, which comes to the X as well. What I want to know is what would you use for this notation as an octarius? And then I'll ask you.
Each component's linked once to the other one.
Correct. So both other ones, yeah. Mm-hmm. So in this example, this is the minimal energy, a global minimum, but you don't get this very often. Most of the time you get a trefoil knot. So this is an example where in optimization you say the capture basin of this is not very large. Right? It's minimal energy, but its capture basin is quite small. So this is that... Are we playing games?
No, I was just going to try to identify that link.
Oh, right.
Is that 631 according to the table?
It looks like the link is complemented to the center fiber. Is it the same center fiber as the up link, just one extra fiber cluster?
It's topologically, I thought it was, you take the hop map, but I think the print is 3 points. Yeah. That's the link that I hope Shura has in his hand.
Three.
So you want to pick?
I'll just pass it around. Just make sure it's the, see if people, we can vote to see if it's the right one.
So the thing I was going to say about energy minimization is probably the least interesting point about this, which is that it's hard to get this. So this is like playing golf on a green that slopes that way. Right? This is the minimal energy. This is the stable solution, which you need to get hole in one to find this. Because if you get quite close to it, it'll just roll down to something else with higher energy. Because the hole has to go deeper than that.
And we shouldn't be distressed that it's actually not three clean links.
Yeah, so this is the isosurface that I've shown you to be able to see them. If you turn up the isosurface, so closer to minus one, these become distinct. But they become very thin, so it's not so easy to see. But you can make them distinct. So no, don't worry about it. Everything's fine, I'm a doctor. Right, so here's the pictures of some of the local and global energy minima of the table in the table I showed you. So I've shown you these were the two at 8. I said at 9 you could get this thing I've just shown you, plus the trefoil knot, and then this is all the things you get at 10, ordered according to energy. So the left hand side is the global minimum, and energy increases as you go to the right. Here's various things at charge 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and a 16. So try and spot your favorite link or not or whatever in there. These are the ones that occur. So far, I've only gone up to 16. So let me just pick out a couple of things to show you on that, which is, this is how you fill in that table beyond 7. So the colored colors denote knot types of various local or global energy minima that I've found. So you can see, so here you get the K4 there. 4-3 torus knot seems to be the best thing. At some points, the link is slightly better than a knot, and so most of these things appear. All right. So what kind of thing happens? Again, here's a spontaneous versus engineered. Suppose you try at charge 12 with the trefoil knot. So I tried at charge 5, and that wasn't twisted enough. If you go to charge 12, well, this has to be twisted 9 times now. So that's twisted too much. So it's not going to like that. And you can see that by doing energy minimization of that one, it starts to kink and bend because it was too twisted. So there's some reconnection that goes on. And then there's some other reconnection that takes place. And then finally, it forms itself into not the knot that you started with, but a different one, which has a higher crossing number, so 4-3 knot, and so it doesn't have to twist so much. So that's the kind of thing that happens. Here's the question that you asked, and I'd like an answer. I don't know what the mass notation is for this. So at 15 and above, you get configurations like this, where they're links, but each component is not, one of the components is itself a knot. So you see here, this one is a charge 2. This is a charge 2 ring. If I've drawn the green curve, it goes around this one, twice. And then there's a trefoil knot, which is charge 8. So that's twisted 5 times. And you add them all together with all the cross linkings, and you get 6.
This isn't now a torus link anymore, is it? This is a link
that's complemented separate fiber. There's standard terminologies for it. I don't know if there's not a uniform one, but Walter Neumann and the book coordinate standard terminology.
Right, so that's the kind of thing I'd like to know, so that if I'm talking to mathematicians, I can use the right language here.
Yeah, in S3, that's an orbit of a 2-3.
So that's the kind of thing that I'd like to know. What's the best language in which to talk to other people about what these things are? So I've probably got a couple of minutes, haven't I?
Yeah, you start a little bit.
So I'm now going to your question, which is, can you think about these as being just curves? With moving by torsion, curvature and effective torsion and so on. So the first thing is, suppose I now, so this is trying to go away from the idea of this meeting, suppose I forget about the knotted field and just try to describe the curve itself. So if you do that, one thing you might imagine is that, well, there should be at least some contribution to the energy which would depend on the length of the curve. So if it's going to work at all, we know that the energy goes like the q to the 3/4, so the length of the curve had better go like q to the 3/4. If this is going to have, this kind of string model will have any chance. So this is a plot of the energies of lots of these local and global minima that I've shown you. That's the dots. And the curve is q to the 3/4, just normalized so that it goes through the charge 1 solution. And what you see is they're not too far off growing like q to the 3/4. So there's a decent chance that you could write down some kind of string or rod model. So how might you try and figure out from some kind of string model at what charge should various knots appear? So here's the most naive thing you can do. In fact, I don't get much better than very naive, but here's my first try. You want to get your Hopf charge, Q. Well, that should split up into two bits. There'll be something contribution from the crossing and something from the twist. So suppose you know which knot you want to get. So choose, say, the trefoil here. You know the crossing. So you know this and you know this, so what should the twist be? So the naive thing to assume is that maybe there's a preferred twist per unit length. Maybe there's a preferred twist rate that it likes to have. And since we know the length goes like q to the 3/4, if that was true, then the amount of twist should go like q to the 3/4. So here's a rough estimate to guess what charge you should need to get various knots. So if I plot, this curve is just this right-hand side, q minus q to the 3/4, and this is just the crossing number. So take crossing number 3, take the trefoil. If you intersect this curve, the closest integer is 7. And that's where we saw the trefoil knot first appear. So that seems to sort of be not too bad. 5, 2, so crossing number 5, go down, the closest integer is 11, and that's where this knot first appears. So all's looking good until you go to the next one, and you try this knot, well, that's crossing number 8, and that tells you that, well, it shouldn't appear until that Hopf charge 16, but the first time this appears as a local energy minimum is 13. So it's giving you something rough, but it's not very accurate. It's kind of qualitative, there's clearly more going on, but it's roughly right. It's sort of in the right direction. So what could you do that's more sophisticated? Let's try and think of these things as being elastic rods. So I already told you about how to create the axisymmetric configuration. You take this cross section of this two-dimensional one and drag it around in a loop and twist a certain number of times. So suppose you take this two-dimensional soliton as a cross section, and instead of dragging it around a circle, drag it around an arbitrary curve, gamma. So you've got this cross section, drag it around, and instead of twisting at constant rate a certain number of times, allow an arbitrary angle in here. So you can twist at whatever rate you like as you go around. So you can take this configuration. This is a field configuration because I've given the cross section. So it's a cross section here, and then everywhere else it's just vacuum. You could take that field configuration, and you could plug it into the energy and compute what does the energy look like in terms of the curve and this rate of twisting. So if you do that, you get a whole bunch of terms. But the leading order ones are contribution, that's just the length of the curve, contribution to integrating the curvature squared, and then a contribution that gives you the difference between the twist rate and the torsion of the curve squared. So there are three constants in here. I can set both these to one if I use the information I know about the charge one. Just, this is just setting energy and length units, so I'll match that to charge one. So there's one parameter here, C, and that will come from some integrals along this cross-section of the two-dimensional thing. So there are extra terms in here, higher order terms that involve things like the derivative of the curvature and things like that. But to make life simple, we're just trying to see if we can get some kind of qualitative description. Let's stick with this because this is just the Kirchhoff energy for an elastic rod.
Excuse me, I missed, I was instructed. This expression is by analogy to elastic systems?
No, by integration.
So you, integration from your system.
Yeah, so you take this expression. Okay. So what do I need to do here? I need to have a two-dimensional solitone, which I know what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And then I just embed that two-dimensional solitone mm-hmm. with a curve and a rate and a twist angle. So I then take that field configuration, plug it into the energy, and integrate out. Oh. And then you get this. Okay. That's what you get, plus some extra terms, that's what I'm saying. There's more complicated terms that involve this.
This is the first order.
This is the first order, and then there's things like the curve derivative.
This is elasticity.
Right, so.
That is linear elasticity.
So, it, yes. So
it's interesting.
So it's just the standard Kirchhoff energy for an elastic rod. Apart from usually when you're thinking of that, the length of the rod is fixed. Whereas for us, the length of the rod comes in here, but that's a free degree of freedom. So it will find its own size. And so this comes back to your point about you can work out, we know that it buckles between 2 and 3, and so that in fact gives you a range of what C can be. And it fits into that range, what you get. So you could start asking questions about, let's minimize this energy. Now, because we've put in this cross-section here, there's a constraint is that for this to be a well-defined field configuration, the cross-section can't intersect another cross-section. So when you write down a curve like this, you have to put in a constraint that it's got a thickness and it's not allowed to intersect. So
it's a cross-section is somewhat.
No, the cross-section is.
It depends on.
The cross section is this two-dimensional soliton that we put in, but that has a scale, and the scale is fixed. The scale depends on the curvature, so that it can't intersect itself. All right. So if it's curved, it has to get thinner. So if you take this, you could ask: does this give anything like the minima of this give anything like the solutions I showed you? And here's some examples. So here the hot solitons I showed do minimal energy at charge 1, 3, 6, and 7. Here's what you get by taking this energy function and minimizing this. So now the difference is, if I start with some topology here, it can't change because it can't self-intersect. So I have to start with various things. So at charge 7, for example, I have to start with all possible things at various charges. They'll all have local minima now, but this is the global one. So you can see it picks out the right topological configurations, and it's not too bad on the actual conformation shape as well. The shapes are not too far off.
So the other topologies get stuck on sort of self-intersection?
Yeah, so they try to sort of collapse down, but then they can't get through each other. Yeah.
So in principle, you get a lower bound from energy by a subset of this two bits.
Yeah, you could get bounds by just specifying. Thing. That's true. We haven't done that, but you could. Yeah. And this comes back to your point I think we made earlier, that for models like this, there are things that grow like Q to the 3/4. And I think that you could probably just derive it from this. And the question is, what would that constant become compared to the kind of Sobolev type arguments? So what have I told you about? That knots form as these minimal energy solitons in here, so they spontaneously form. You get various torus knots that appear at different charges, but I haven't got anything that's a knot that's not a torus knot. So the question is there some energetic reason why? Or it's always that I started with various things that were always torus knots. So maybe it's just I haven't been clever enough. I mean, there was no figure of eight, for example. Maybe it's just I haven't been clever enough because I haven't started with anything that's a figure of eight. Maybe if I start with a figure of eight knot at the right charge, there will be some local minimum. And in fact, that's something that I've started to work on last week when I saw Mark's talk, and he showed me there exactly what my denominator should be. It's these semi-complex curves that he uses. So we can now replace what we were doing before by this semi-complex denominator and just try and figure out what the right numerator is, to at least start with things that are, say, the figure of eight knot and see what happens to them. It could be that there are things that are figure of eight knots or non-torus knots. It could be that they're not, but... Yeah, so it's holomorphic in one of the variables, but not the other. So I'm seeing that this description in terms of rational maps for starting configurations is quite a good description, even qualitatively. This elastic rod model captures some of the main features. We haven't really extended it. There'd be lots of things you could do. That's the sort of more recent work. Talks about trying to do these bounds or trying to improve these higher order terms. And there's other models. I've shown you what's the most popular one. But there are other examples. You write down different energy functions, and they all seem to qualitatively behave like this. At least the ones I've tried, you get the same kind of knots and links. Sometimes the energy ordering is switched between a couple, but the same kind of things. So I don't know if you want to hear about physical applications.
Yes.
So the original physical application for this is in high energy physics to describe states called glue balls. So if you imagine quarks are confined, and they're confined by exchange of gluons, but you can think of that as having two quarks here and a flux tube between them that ties to the end of it. So now you ask, what happens if there were no quarks? So I still have this flux tube, I still have this gluonic flux tube, but instead of ending on the quarks, it now has to end on itself. So you have to take this flux tube and you have to close it up to form a ring or a knot or something more complicated. Well, those states are called glue balls, and they're very hard to study within normal field theory because they're highly non-perturbative, and they also mix with other mesonic states. So it's very difficult to get information on them. The best information comes from lattice QCD, where they estimate that the lowest energy glue ball has an energy of about 2 GeV, so about twice as heavy as the proton. But these are states that are thought to exist, but we don't really know a good way of describing them. And the idea is that these will describe those states, that these will be these knotted flux tube, and you get and you'll be able to, the stability comes from this kind of knotting. So how do you try and get to a model like that? So you start with your Young-Mills theory, and you write down, which is a non-abelian gauge theory, you have to exchange the gauge field for the variables I've got here, this n unit vector. So it's one of these dual variable descriptions. You write down an explicit expression for the gauge field in terms of this field n. It's something like that a mu looks like sort of the derivative d mu of n crossed with n, roughly speaking. It's something like that. It's that kind of change of variables. But then there's other terms. That doesn't have enough degrees of freedom. So you have to add in some other fields as well. If you take just this n degree of freedom, plug it back into the Young-Mills Lagrangian, you get this kind of Schoenflot AF energy function.
Can you write down the formula you just said on chip?
Thanks. So, since you asked, I'll do it over here. Okay.
Fine. Thank you.
So, all right, so you think of this, the gauge field as being a vector. Right, this U2 valued, so you think of it as a three-component vector dotted with a Pauli matrix.
Yes.
So then I want to write this down, this vector. That's the kind of change of variables. But now there's not enough degrees of freedom in here, in N. So there's other things that that have to appear, things like a new field C that comes with an N. Then what else have I got? Another field that will tell me something like d mu n. So the idea is that your basis for your vector is n, its derivative, and the cross product.
So n has, can you just count degrees of freedom for me? N is 2.
Yeah, you can count the degrees of freedom. There's another term here that has the complex version of this in here. So okay. What it comes down to is we have this, what you end up with is an abelian, it's a gauged fixed version, and you end up with this vector n. You then end up with an abelian gauge potential and a complex scalar field. So it looks like this model that I've talked about, coupled to some Ginzburg-Landau type theory, if you like, some abelian. And what they show is, if suppose you neglected these and said this was the important degree of freedom, then you'd get their sort of Skirm-Padeff type term out of that. But the questions are, what happens when you introduce these extra things? Does all these nice properties go away or not? That's still under discussion. Nobody has a very good argument why you should be able to do this. Like coupling these extra fields into this doesn't destroy all these properties.
So your A mu is now complex because of phi?
No, so there's another term in here, which I can't remember what it goes in front of, but there's another real field here. So let me call this phi 1. Forget what goes there, but there's something there, and then you make phi is phi 1 plus I phi 2. So there's two real degrees of freedom, but if you look how the symmetry acts, they transform as a pair, as a complex field. So you end up with a abelian gauge potential, a complex scalar, and this three-component unit vector. But there's still juries out on whether or not, if you start coupling all these things in, do you really have all this, or do things get destroyed? And then there's more than 100 papers on this model taking similar kind of ideas as this, saying, can we have knots in a two-component Bose-Einstein condensate, for example? So you have to pick out your unit vector n there. So in that example, you would have two-component Bose-Einstein condensate, two complex scalars. You would say, let me take out the length, that's one degree of freedom, and then I've got a direction, and then try and freeze one angle. So things like that. So, on the record, aren't I? I'm not terribly convinced by any of these papers that there really is a physical model I can point to that's definitely described by this. But there's lots and lots of people who are trying very hard. Perhaps too hard, but trying very hard. And that's one of the reasons is I think that this model has such interesting solutions. If you could find any physical system that was described roughly by this, plus some extra terms that don't destroy it, there'd be nice, very nice things to look at. You'd be able to see all these knots and stuff in them. That's kind of the state of which we're at. So the final thing is just to say, if you are interested, so I'm sure lots of things look familiar because lots of things look familiar in other people's talks. So it's the best combination, I think, is to see something familiar in a different setting. If you're interested in seeing how we use these kind of topological solitons, which I guess you call defects or textures or whatever you like, we call them topological solitons. If you want to know how they're used in particle physics particularly, here's a shameless advert for my book, with Nick Manton. You can find out all about that, available from all good bookstores by definition. Thank you.
Thanks. As usual, Paul took lots and lots of good questions during the week, but probably there's some more. I know I have at least one.
So you could also think of this vector field N as, if you wrote N dot tau like that,
yes.
Then you could think of it as a Hamiltonian for a two-state quantum mechanical system.
Yeah.
Right. Is there an energy functional on the, is there some natural, I'm asking everybody, maybe you too, is there a natural energy functional on that space?
I don't.
The energy of the ambient field.
No, 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 so I'm, there's no A. I'm just gonna take, I'm gonna say, two-state system, but the energy level changes as I move around space, right? So I write the Hamiltonian as N dot sigma, right? So that's the two-state system, it's giving me the two energy levels.
Yeah.
N never vanishes, so there's always a gap,
mm-hmm.
right, between the two. Is there some sense in putting an energy functional on that?
So I think there might be, but my guess is the problem is to try and get this higher order derivative. That's the main problem with all these things. If you want to have something that doesn't shrink down, working against the extreme, you need something that has quartic in derivatives. So that's why this kind of ansatz works, because A looks like a derivative, and then F looks like a derivative of this,
sure.
So you get something fourth order. So I think if you just start writing down, just starting with N, I think it's hard to get a high derivative. I mean, that's the, when I've talked to people in condensed matter, they'd say that's the difficulty in getting all these systems, is they don't have anything higher derivatives in condensed matter. You tend to write down things that are quartic in derivatives, quadratic in derivatives, but things that are quartic in derivatives play a role.
Well, but they're dangerously irrelevant. I mean, they're still there.
Yes, so the question is, I guess what happens in condensed matter is that the things you can neglect because the coefficient is so small in front of them, that if you tried to use that to stabilize some size, the size of the object you get would be smaller than you're interested in.
So does anybody look at interactions between solitons? I mean, you showed us some part of individual solitons with different half charge. Yeah. Does anyone look at scattering between different states?
Yeah, so you could. So one way to start, I said I've started with something that's actually symmetric. One way would just be, if you want to start with charge 7, start with 7 well-separated single ones.
Mm-hmm.
You could do that. They interact, they attract, but rather weakly. So in terms of energy minimization, it takes a long time for the things to come together. But you can work out, say, asymptotic forces between them based on looking at them as dipoles far away, so asymptotic fields. Yeah, that's been done.
And is it known how the interactions scale with the two off charges?
No, I think everything that's been done has been...
Does it go like Q1 to the 3/4 times Q3 to the 3/4?
I think everything that's been done is with taking single ones, because you need to have a good... you can have a reasonably decent approximation for a single one and then work out analytically asymptotics for that. But it's... nobody's tried it with one of these more complicated things.
So there's no interaction between two trefoil analysis?
Nobody knows what that is.
Yeah, just let me follow up on that. So the example I thought you might try would be not this link, but Hopf link, and then some isolated Hopf link, and whether they come together to give basically connected sum of the two Hopf links or something that's...
Yeah, so you can... So you can definitely try that. I've started with things like that. You tend to get stuck in local energy minima very quickly. So what happens is it will link one component and then quite happily sit just linking that one component, but have energy that's much higher than these bounds, so you know it's a local energy minima. Yeah, you can get things like that. So you see the two endpoints don't really see each other, and so they're reasonably happy to sit there as some local energy minima.
I had a different question that was more towards how you would detect a blue ball or just infer, rather, because I don't know how you see it directly, but the work Dorothy coming in sort of, so this may be a little bit off the wall, but you've been able to infer from sort of input output the existence of certain, sort of, I want to think of them as sort of circles in which I have to do surgery or something, but does anyone have a way of deciding, you can see, presumably, the quark somehow in the particle experiment, maybe you don't see.
No, so that's the problem.
That's the problem.
You could have a Nobel Prize if you could think of a way to do that.
But whether you can infer from input output the existence of closed loops of
No, so it's even worse than that. It's even foggier than that. Is that you're just trying to infer existence of some state. You don't even know details of it. You're just trying to figure out, is there a glue ball state in there, just by trying to figure out So what's happened is
there's tables and tables and tables, even more impressive than the non-tables, resonances that they've discovered.
Yeah.
Right? And you can subscribe. Every 2 years you can get a copy mailed to you. Right. You can get a little pocket one.
Very cool. You can buy truck or something.
No, you can get a little pocket one. And then they try to classify all the different states using the approximate SU3 symmetries and so forth. And then every now and then they find us and say, well, we don't know how to classify this. Maybe it's a Google.
Yeah. That's pretty much.
Or pentaquark state, or you know, something that we don't know, right? It's something we don't know.
And if it lasts more than about 3 or 4 years, it's probably something. Yeah. If it doesn't go away in the data.
Okay. Does there exist a school global minimizer for any value of the charge? Google very well.
So in terms of proofs,
yes.
If you're an analyst, what's proved is that there is a finite, that there's an infinite set of charges for which a minimizer exists. Infinite set, but it doesn't, no information about what that set is.
And is there a proof of the existence of some node which cannot arise as a solitary in this context? Not just that you have not observed it, just a mathematical proof that.
No, because I think that's a question about energy minimization, because
yes.
You can certainly write down an initial condition for any knot that you like, and then it's a tricky problem in energy minimization, whether or not there's a solution that preserves that topology.
Okay, so there's no restriction restriction for to fiber knots or something,
not that I know of.
No, I mean these cipher vibrations that he was showing at the very beginning show that's not the case. But because you've got this top charge, which is a global constraint, but there's no constraint coming from the S1 because
right.
of S2.
Yeah. So I think anything is up for grabs. Okay. Thank you.